Blog Talk Radio.
You know there's more to this world than what you're told. Paranormal phenomenon, supernatural forces, government conspiracies, alien visitors. Step out of the world you see, open up your mind, and get ready for another round of strange at the Supernatural Radio Show with Corrine DeWinter and Nino Del Padre. Brought to you by PurplePlates.com for harmony, healing, and living energy products for a greater quality of life. Listen up, world. Here's Corrine and Nino.
Hey, everybody. Thanks for being here tonight. And I'm really excited because I wanted to have a show on Bigfoot forever. And finally, I found the brilliant Kathy Strain, who I formerly did not know about. I'm glad I discovered her, and it is really a treat to have her here tonight. I'm going to tell you a little bit about her before I bring her on. Kathy Moskowitz Strain is currently the forest archaeologist for the Stanislaus National Forest in Sonora, California. She's responsible for all the archaeological and paleontological resources on her forest and directs education and public participation programs on archaeology and Native American cultures. Kathy is currently the chair of the Alliance of Independent Bigfoot Researchers, a nonprofit Bigfoot research group. Kathy became interested in Bigfoot as a child, and her interest led her into the field of anthropology. Kathy received a Bachelor of Arts degree in anthropology in 1990 and a Master of Arts in Behavioral Science emphasis in anthropology in 1994. Her main field of study involved prehistoric human ecology. In 1991, as an archaeologist for the Sequoia National Forest, she began interviewing elders from the Yukut tribe about their traditional hairy man stories. This work led her to an in-depth study of the hairy man pictographs located on the Tule River Indian Reservation. Very interesting. She has presented her research at the 2003 Willow Creek Symposium, the 2005 Texas Bigfoot Conference, and she's been a speaker at multiple conferences over the years. Also, she published an article in Meet the Sasquatch by Chris Murphy. Recently, she appeared on the Giganto, the Real King Kong special on the History Channel. And also, she's been on Monster Quest, Monster Quest Bigfoot, the Definitive Guide America on Earth, and several other television shows. And she also is the author of the book Giants, Cannibals, and Monsters, Bigfoot and Native Culture. And I think we're going to ask her where we can get those books. I'm assuming Amazon, but maybe not. Also, using her specialty in human ecology, Kathy explores the connection between Native American adaptation of the environment and how Bigfoot might also have used similar techniques to exploit plants and animals. Comparisons may be found in habitation, methods and locations, hunting and gathering techniques, resource availability, calorie input, output, seasonal movements, all that kind of stuff. Knowing this information may foster collection of evidence not previously associated with Bigfoot behavior. It may also allow us to develop techniques to better obtain direct observations and therefore documentation and protection of this currently unrecognized primate. So with Kathy's huge accomplishments, I'm going to bring her on. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Thanks for joining us tonight, really. I mean, I can't believe you've spent your whole life researching Bigfoot, and you've got a job that kind of allows you to explore that further too. And I know you say you got into Bigfoot when you were little. Tell me a little bit about what it's like to be a Bigfoot researcher. I can imagine it's pretty frustrating.
It can be at times, and more so is because you deal with people who have these preconceived ideas of what facts or what something is, when in reality they don't have any clue what they're talking about, but it doesn't stop them from making unfounded comments or judgments without actually looking at the information. And it's getting more so as time goes by, where you just find somebody who said, oh, yeah, I heard a rumor that the Patterson-Gimlin film, which is the most famous film of Bigfoot that was taken in 1967, that some person confessed on their deathbed that they were, you know, the person in the suit. And
I
that's
heard
not true.
That, too. Yeah, I heard that.
It never happened. And so, but people take internet stories or something they think they heard without looking into it and finding out, did that really ever happen? And it happens a lot, where there's an article going on the web right now that it's a joke tabloid that said that the Smithsonian had admitted to destroying skeletons of large humans that they had collected in the 1800s. And that the case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ruled in favor of, you know, admitting this evidence, and that never happened. There is no court case. I mean, it's easy to verify by going to, okay, U.S. Supreme Court, have you ever had a case that involved the Smithsonian? No, you never have. And then everybody that they quote in the article doesn't exist. And so that's the kind of thing I think is the most frustrating, is having something valuable to say, and people who have been, in my mind, tainted by falsehoods are unwilling to listen, and they keep a hold of that paradigm that's already been shown to be false. So it's a little frustrating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, because like you just said, I heard that story about the guy on his deathbed, and then I heard the other things that you mentioned as well. And so, I mean, when someone, and I know a lot of people must say to you, Kathy, come on, Bigfoot, seriously. But how much evidence do we have, Kathy, that Bigfoot does in fact exist?
Well, we have, I get treated very well because I'm a professional, and I don't get people who mock me or anything to that extent, because I'm actually also a witness. I have seen them myself. And so I'm usually treated very much with respect. And so I haven't had those kinds of experiences. I know others have, of course. Well, for evidence-wise, we don't have a body and we don't have DNA. That's the long and short of it. However, we do have other forms of evidence, including footprints that have been casted. We have eyewitness accounts. We have hair samples that don't ever seem to get to the right place where they're supposed to be, but the strongest is the footprints, because that demonstrates a physical being that, you know, you can't leave footprints unless you exist. And so that remains at this point, besides the Patterson-Gimlin film, which is that film I mentioned earlier, the best evidence that we have.
Right. And, you know, of course, most people listening probably know what that film is. I mean, I that's how I got into Bigfoot when I was young, is that I think it was on In Search Of or something like that. But that, still, that is an incredible, incredible film. And, you know, I have people argue with me, Kathy. Of course, I'm not an archaeologist and everything you are. But they're like, you know, come on, if a Bigfoot existed, why haven't we seen one, or why haven't we caught one? I think they're a little smarter than that.
Oh, I think they're way smarter than that. And who's to say that we don't have remains of them right now? I mean, I can't say with any certainty that we don't already have them in a museum or some other place, and we just don't recognize them for what they are. I mean, if they're closely related to us genetically, which I suspect be based on evolutionary processes, you know, how do we know that they just have not been misidentified? And I can't say that. But I also do know enough about human population that if there was a skeleton out in the woods that looked interesting, I guarantee you the public in general is not going to know what it is, and they are not going to collect it because most of the general public is not educated in what the remains of any species is that's out in the forest. You know, a skeleton will quickly become disarticulated. Other animals quickly take it upon themselves to eat what they can from that skeleton because it's a food source. I mean, all kinds of bugs and other critters that will drag a skeleton apart from each other. I mean, there's all kinds of factors why it most likely wouldn't be found whole. And then to find somebody who not only recognizes in the right spot at the right time, recognizes it for what it is, and collects it, I mean, the odds of that are just so slim. And by the time somebody who might know what it is shows up, those things have already decomposed. In our forest environment, it takes very little time for something to decompose.
Right. And there's also the theory that they actually bury each other like to such a degree that we wouldn't find their remains.
And I doubt that to be true. That the concept of burial is based on solely on religion. And we didn't develop that until about the Neanderthal age when their brains would have been big enough to start a concept of wondering, is there something after death? You know, could, if I preserve this body exists in a spirit world? And so I don't see any evidence of a Bigfoot having that cognitive, that higher level of knowledge ability. I mean, it's for us, even humans, it was only developed, you know, maybe 100,000 years ago, even for us, where we had that concept. So, mm-hmm. And that's the other thing that's difficult sometimes is the need to ascribe Bigfoot human behaviors. You know, like I often get told, oh, well, they make tools. Well, we don't know that they make tools, and why would they need to make tools? They are perfect within themselves. We make tools because we don't have teeth that can tear meat or fingernails that can tear meat, or, you know, we don't have any, no, we've evolved to a place where we no longer have those capabilities. Bigfoot doesn't need a tool to tear something apart. He can just use his brute strength in order to do that. So why would he need tools? You know, but it's an assumption because we're human, we know we need tools, that he would need it as well, when in reality, no, he's perfectly fine without it.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. Kathy, what do you think of the theory that Bigfoot is interdimensional or part of? Because I will say I have read a few instances of Bigfoot spottings, and there seem to be UFO activity at the same time. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I haven't studied that in particular aspect, but I don't think it's a necessary place to go. I mean, there's no reason to consider it. I mean, he's an animal. He doesn't, you know, have any special abilities, so I don't know why. I don't know where that theory comes from, but I don't ascribe to an alien source for the animal. He's just an animal that evolved here on Earth just like everything else, and that's it. You know, we just got to do better on trying to identify him.
Right. Of course, I really want to hear about your encounters, that, you know, your witness accounts on Bigfoot. Can you tell us about those?
Oh, sure. And it's one of those things that you spend your life, you know, studying Bigfoot, but you don't actually have an encounter. And then when you finally do, you're just so shocked and odd, you can hardly function, you know, that kind of thing. But I was in Oklahoma in 2012, and I was at a location of a cabin that had been having quite a bit of activity in the past, and sightings, footprints, all that stuff that was happening there. And I was invited to come out to basically see for myself what was happening on the property. And this place is very remote. The accommodations there's no electricity. I think it has a generator that, but once the batteries are powered, you can have a little bit of power. But basically, it's rugged camping, just with, you know, a four walls and a roof over your head. You know, it would have been the same if we had just, you know, tent camped. And we were, it was about 6 o'clock in the evening, and we had had some interesting activity prior to this, and basically it was a, it sounded like somebody, something had thrown a rock onto another cabin that was nearby and hit the roof, and it was a metallic roof, a metal roof, so it made a big sound, and they went over to check it out, and when they had come back, we sat around a rock outdoor fireplace, but you know, just a one built like what you see in a forest with a hunter would build. It's not professionally done or anything. It's just rocks that delineate where you can have a fire. And we had been sitting there just a few minutes when we started hearing, it sounded like bipedal footprints and or something coming at us, you know, but you know, leaves rustling, something in the grass, and we were like, whoa, you know, what is that? And right about then, based on how my chair was sitting, I could see two Bigfoots, and one was very large, and the other one was smaller. And I knew I didn't have a whole lot of time to, you know, see what I was seeing, and so I kind of blanked out the small one and just concentrated on the big one. I got up out of my chair, and I said, there they are, and I ran at them. And I caused, because I ran in front of the camera, the motion-triggered camera that they had on the property, all you see is me running by it, and then I stand in front of it. So you get a great view of me from behind. And I watched it. Now that it knew that we could see them, I think they were trying to get closer to us, and they were going to get behind this old shed that was there. And but because I said, there they are, they now are aware that we know they're there, and I'm running at them, the big one turns and just goes up this hillside like nothing I've ever seen before. I mean, it was like the wind. It was like if he had had a bungee cord on him and somebody just let go of it, and he just went up that hillside like it was absolutely nothing. And for those of you who know anything about Oklahoma, that place is trying to kill you at every opportunity. You just can't even believe it. I mean, it's got greenbrier, that there are these horrible vines that go on the ground that like to, you know, catch you on your shoe and trip you into the ground. It's got snakes. It's got everything. And this hillside was pretty steep. It had, you know, big rocks that you would have to terrain, and this thing just went up that hillside just like it wasn't even there. And then the small one followed afterwards, but I was still watching the big one. And the small one basically went up very similar to the big one. And then after it got to the top, then it kind of relaxed a little bit. And another member, there was five of us there at the time, including my husband, and four of us saw exactly the same thing. And the fifth one just didn't see it. And then as we got closer to the hillside, it was about 50 yards from us, where we saw it go up the hillside, we stayed and hovered there for hours later, and we saw the big one then walk across on the contour, just picked up the top of his head, walking across that contour. And so, you know, it was a giant hair-covered, black hair, hair on its face, skin color. You couldn't tell. I wasn't close enough, but it looked to be the same color as the hair. And it reminded me of a big ape. It was just very ape-like. And then that rest of the week, we had quite a bit of other activity where we had rocks thrown at us, what you would call a wood knocks. But I didn't have another sighting that week. My husband got to see another one later on in that week. But it was pretty exciting. And then last year, right, 2013, I saw a something small in a tree. It was black, and it was about the size of, I have a dog, that, so I was guessing somewhere around 30 pounds, probably a little lighter. But I saw it walk out onto a tree limb, and that's what caught my eye the first place, because the whole tree was shaking, and I was like, what's going on? And I saw it go out onto the end of a branch, had no tail, flat back. It was gripping the branch with hands. I saw it bounce the tree limb and then jump across a clearing into the next tree across the clearing. And I said, oh, my God, you know, I think I just saw baby Bigfoot in a tree. We ran up that. All we could see was the path of the tree shaking of what where it had already gone and was long out of our viewed by then. So it was pretty amazing. And I don't know what else to say that was. I mean, it wasn't a squirrel. It wasn't a rabbit. It wasn't anything that you would call that would normally be in a tree going tree to tree. This thing was using that tree as a tool to get across the clearing into wherever else it was headed. So that's pretty exciting to me. I of everything, that was probably my favorite because it was just so my first initial thing was, oh, it's a chimp. A chimp got loose or something, and there's a chimp in the tree. And then I went, chimp in a tree in Oklahoma. I need to, run at it again. So.
Right. Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was pretty, for me, very, very, so much so that I considered that area to be the richest. And if I could retire tomorrow and spend all my time Bigfooting, that is where I would go.
Oh,
my
God. See, I didn't realize that because I always think they're more north, in the northern regions. But is that's not true?
No, they're definitely found throughout the United States in forested areas. That seems to be a key need of theirs, where it has to have rainfall and it has to have resources, to eat. And so basically, use anywhere a black bear could live, a Bigfoot could live as well. And so that habitat clearly has bears in it. And so, there's no reason for them not to be there. So, yeah, a lot of people associate Bigfoot with the Pacific Northwest, but that really isn't true. So they can be anywhere with those conditions.
Yeah. Now, we mentioned one of your books, Kathy. Do you have more than one?
No, just one.
Okay, and where can people find... Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. They can find it on Amazon or my publisher, who is Hancock House Publications. And it's a collection of traditional Native American Bigfoot stories that just kind of point out what the relationships Native Americans had with Bigfoots. Most of them are of course, they were only collected once we had people here to collect them. And so they're not from, 2 million years ago. Well, no, that's a bad example. They're not from 2,000 years ago. They're from the late 1800s, sometimes the 1700s, until, the 1920s or so.
Mm-hmm. And what was the relationship like? I mean, because I know an Apache, and he says that whenever someone would see a Bigfoot, it was a warning sign. It meant mm-hmm. something bad was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
It varies from tribe to tribe.
Right.
Some tribes have a very good relationship, like the Yokuts that you mentioned that have the hairy man pictographs that I've done work on. They have a very strong belief system that he is here to help that tribe in particular, and that he has a specific purpose of protecting the dead. He takes them to the other side of the spirit world when somebody dies. They have lots of traditional songs that are in regards to Bigfoot. And then there's other tribes that they did not get along at all, and they did everything possible to just stay out of his way, basically. They so much so that they would divide up the berry bushes and say, well, these bushes will belong to him, but these bushes over here belong to us. And they never violated those agreements.
Wow.
They basically just wanted nothing to do with them. And then mm-hmm. there are tribes who believe still today that, yes, seeing one is a bad omen. A lot of tribes believe that once Bigfoot is discovered and proven real, that is the end of this current age that we're living in, because he's the protector of the forest. And without him, that's when mankind ends. And so, it's varied. You can't say all tribes believe X. It depends on the tribe.
Right. Now, Kathy, I'm sure you've heard that some people that have seen Bigfoot, witnessed Bigfoot, had mind communication with them. Like mm-hmm. they would hear things in their mind, you know, without actually voicing anything. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that I don't think that's truly what's happening. Let's be blunt. I think those people are just talking to themselves in their own head. It's kind of like what I do when I say, hey, you know, I wonder if I should have that cake, and my head says, oh, yeah, you should have that cake because I want to agree with myself. And so I don't think it's any different than that, because it's some of these tales that they tell, the purpose of the communications is always to make that person more important, if that makes sense. So they're not just casual, hey, dude, you know, you need to start living your life better. It's always some communication that goes, you've been chosen, you're the only person who can receive this message because you're so awesome and special, and we just want to tell you how awesome and special you are. And it's kind of like, well, there's lots of people. If I was a Bigfoot and I had the ability to communicate, I think I'd be picking, you know, the President of the United States or somebody really super important and saying, hey, you know, we don't like what you guys are doing. Stop cutting down the forest. Stop doing X and Y. And I think, you know, that to me, that's what would make sense. And one time I asked one of these gentlemen who, he was quite upset about the concept of, you know, that in the end, science is going to need a body because we're just not being successful getting DNA. And he was truly very upset because he felt like he had this relationship with them. And I asked him, I said, well, if you truly believe that you're having a communication with this Bigfoot, have you ever tried to reason with the Bigfoot and say, hey, why don't you just give me a sample of your DNA? We can prove it scientifically. Nobody's going to need a body after that. But yet we can then do what's needed to preserve, you know, your species as a whole. And the man's reaction was one of such, I don't know what the word I want to use for that. It was not the reaction of somebody that I would expect to say, you know, that's reasonable. I should try to do that because that will save these creatures from having a loss. And so to me, I know if I could give blood or a hair follicle or whatever it is that science wants for me in order to prevent something that I think is tragic from happening, I'll make that happen. You know, I will gladly give blood to that cause. And so for somebody to become extraordinarily angry from being asked that question, to me is an indicator that they know this isn't really happening. They know that Bigfoot's not talking to them in their head, but it's something that they want, they're choosing to believe in because it makes them feel better about
right.
whatever it is they don't feel good about. And so, and plus, I've never had them, you know, demonstrate any ability of like, well, what does the Bigfoot say about Kathy Strain? You know, can that Bigfoot who obviously knows me because I've been around, what does he have to say about me? And they can't ever tell me anything that's intimate or special or where I've been or anything. And so, you know.
Right,
It's that whole, they've got nothing to prove that it happens. And so I just, until such time as, you know, some guy can walk up to me and say, well, Bigfoot said he wants you to stop eating this particular thing that nobody on earth but my husband knows I do, then maybe I'll put a little more stock in it.
Right, right. Well, that was a good test, you know. And, you know, Kathy, you know, if you go on YouTube, you put in Bigfoot sightings, you're going to get thousands of, first of all, jokes and other things. Are there any good films besides the Patterson film that you feel like, you know, us Bigfoot enthusiasts should see?
Yeah, actually there is quite, there's a thermal that's known as the Brown Thermal that was taken in Washington. It's the Browns live on an Indian reservation. It's the, I'm not going to get it right, so I'm not going to say because my brain isn't working. But they live on an Indian reservation, and it's a very remote place. And they have been having visitations. Sarah Brown, in particular, has documented her evidence perfectly. She keeps a journal. She records all the time. So she has a good indicator. She has probably on her website is probably some of the best vocalizations I've heard in a long time. They're very good. And they caught a Bigfoot on thermal. And the Bigfoot is below slope, and it's just basically watching them. And there's some cows that are roaming the property because, they, you know, they're a reservation, so they have cows. And it doesn't do much. It just kind of watches them. And then I think they ran out of batteries, and I think that's why the recording ends. But it's worth looking into it. I really feel that that's authentic, and I feel like they do indeed have Bigfoot on their on the property that they have there on the reservation. And I hope to get out there myself to do some work. And so I highly recommend that. And there's also a video that's known as the Squeaky video that was taken by Michael Green, G-R-E-E-N-E, and you can find that on YouTube as well. And I believe it's been on Finding Bigfoot as well. It is also a thermal. And this Michael had been doing research at this particular location for literally years and years worth of work. And he had been leaving, like, candy bars and gifts and stuff to intrigue a Bigfoot to come out into the open. And he has a thermal as well. In fact, he was one of the first researchers, I would say, that used thermals on a regular basis in their research. And this one evening, he left he left a candy bar, and I don't remember the brand now in particular, but he left it out on a stump, and this time, unlike he had done in the past, he left the area. He moved over to a different location and just kind of slept in the car with the camera aimed at the location of where he had left the candy bar. And he got video, and it is pretty darn good. This animal doesn't know where Michael is. And so it's very cautionary. It's going behind, and it's standing behind a tree, and it, you can see it looking out and seeing if they see anything, and then going back behind the tree and then looking out, you know, just briefly trying to see where Michael had gone. It obviously knows the candy bar is there, but he probably can smell it and wants it, but is leery about coming out into the public in general to get it. And so you just watch this creature basically, not slither, that's not the right word, but basically you get down on maybe its belly or on four hands and knees and hands, and go up really cautionary to the stump, grab the candy bar off the stump, and then kind of slink back into the forest. And then there's additional film that shows it continuing to look to see, well, did I get caught doing that? You know, is there still anybody not watching and that kind of thing. And it's just exactly what I would expect a Bigfoot to behave. And you can tell that it's large. Whatever's in that video is very large. So I highly recommend those. Yeah.
Okay, so that's the Michael Green Squeaky Bigfoot. If we put that in, we should be able to find it.
Yeah, you should be able to find it. So those are the two that I highly recommend. You know, they're thermals, but they're still very good film. I mean, thermals are probably the wave of the future for most researchers anyway, because, you know, Bigfoot's nocturnal. It's going to be doing most of its activity at night, and so that's the best tool to use to do that kind of research.
Right. So where you live, you're in California, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So do you get many local sightings, or have you investigated anything near you?
Oh, yes, yes. The county that I live in is the second highest reported Bigfoot sightings anywhere in California. We're just outside of Yosemite National Forest, National Park. Oh, I can't believe we called it a forest. People have probably heard of Yosemite before. It's just this obviously made by God place. I mean, it's just beautiful. And we're pretty remote in the sense of where we currently live is the National Forest gets I think about 2 million visitors a year, but they pretty much concentrate around the lakes and fishing that we have. So they're not just everywhere. And we have quite a few wildlife preserves where there's no hunting or you can't even carry a gun and anywhere within that sanctuary. And so we have, you know, millions of acres when you include the Park Service and wilderness and everything that's around us that is good Bigfoot habitat. And so, yeah, and we get reports, you know, often I'm at the grocery store and I have people come up to me that because I've been in the paper and I've been on lots of television shows and plus we have a website. So I get a lot of stuff that comes in that we investigate. And I just literally got one. This one that we just received after actually came to me from an employee in the Forest Service. He had been out doing patrols and got stopped by, and maybe I should backtrack just a little bit. My national forest, the Stanislaus National Forest, if you watched the news last summer and heard about the biggest wildfire to occur in the Sierra Nevadas, that was on us. So it burned 257,000 acres. And so you can imagine that it's gigantic. And it burned into Yosemite as well. And we finally, in fact, that fire started August 17th, 2013, and we just called it out in October.
Wow.
Or no, I guess early November. So it was a gigantic fire. Because of my responsibilities as the forest archaeologist, we, of course, have been doing lots of surveys and doing quite a bit of work trying to get those acres prepared for harvesting. We're going to cut some of the dead trees, you know, so that they don't fall and become hazards later. And during the course of that work, no large mammal bodies were found. And so it's very clear to me that the bears got out. And so there's a few deer carcasses that we have found and unfortunately cows that were using the forest for grazing. We lost quite a few of those because they got caught behind fence lines. But no other large, and it's not even that extensive how many little bones we found. So that tells me that they moved somewhere, you know, because that was actually the rim fire was the area where I conducted most of my research. And so you can imagine how I felt about, you know, knowing that where I knew there was Bigfoots was going up to be in flames.
Oh, I know.
So they had to, yeah, it was not very fun. It was if I don't ever go through another wildfire again in my career, I think I'll be pretty darn happy about it because it's almost too much, you know, to lose that much stuff.
Oh, yeah.
So,
terrible.
Yeah. And so based on that information, I was fully expecting sightings to start coming in from locations where we weren't really getting them before. And that's exactly what's happening, is that we're getting sighting reports in locations where historically for us, we haven't had that much activity. And so that tells, and that's another factor to consider when you talk about Bigfoot. Why would somebody, if somebody was going to hoax a Bigfoot, you know, I would do research and find out where the most common Bigfoot sightings are, and that's where I would do stuff. You know, it takes a lot of effort and work to put together the nuances of, oh, if we just had this large wildfire, it would make logical sense to me that the Bigfoot would no longer be seen in there, and then so I will go somewhere else to hoax it. So they just don't – somebody who hoaxes isn't even that bright, so I don't think that they're going to figure that out.
No.
Yeah. And so anyway, so these sightings have been coming in from locations where we historically haven't had them, and this particular one, he had stopped a Forest Service employee to basically tell him what had happened and kind of report it, but didn't really at first the employee felt like, well, I mean, are you asking us to do something, or, you know, what is it that you want by telling us about this? And he goes, well, I'm just worried that they're dangerous, and so I just wanted you guys to know that they're in here, and if, you know, you need to post a sign or whatever, I just want to let you know. And of course, there's no reason to think that a Bigfoot is dangerous, so we're not going to post a sign. But that employee then, when he got back to the office, called me and said, I just want to let you know that this is what was reported. And so I they gave that gentleman my name in case he wanted to do something more formal, and he has chosen not to do that so far, but he might consider it, you know, calling me directly and me having a chat with him. But I got pretty good details about it, so.
Yeah, so, that's really interesting. He was afraid to talk about it, obviously, right?
Oh, yeah. He at first, he kind of was, they said he was clear he wanted to say something because he had motioned them, you know, when they were doing their, what they do is they do patrols of where dispersed camping is, and then they, you know, if somebody doesn't have a permit to have a fire, they say, hey, you have to have a permit, or if they're leaving their trash behind, or we have to put out a fire because somebody left without putting it out. That's what caused the rim fire, was somebody who didn't put their fire out. And they had passed through, and he had waved at them, indicating he wanted to say something. And then when they got out of the car and said, oh, you know, how you doing? He had a tough time getting it out. He was like, well, you know. And I think he was worried that somebody would think he was a kook. And so he didn't really want to say, well, I saw a Bigfoot, or this is what happened. He kind of danced around it until finally the employee said, are you saying that this is what happened? And then it was a Bigfoot? And you know, that's okay, dude. You know, if you want to, you know, we're not going to make fun of you. Just tell us what happened so we know what's going on. And he felt greatly relieved, you know, like, oh, God, okay, thanks for saying that, because I didn't want to just come out and blurt this out, kind of thing. So yeah, he wasn't looking for attention. He wasn't looking for, you know, fame. It hasn't appeared in the paper. He just literally had this experience, and he wanted the Forest Service to be aware of it. And so we are, and I'll be watching that area with due diligence from here on out, because I know that they move someplace, and hopefully this is the place that they move to.
Right. Wow. So, I mean, how close, do you know how close he got to the Bigfoot, or?
Not too close. He stayed his distance, but the Bigfoot obviously did not want him there, because during the night when the commotion had first started, they didn't find it till the next morning, but it had taken his frying pan and bent it in half. He had, I can't remember, I'll have to see my notes, but he did something else too that was very destructive. And bears don't take pans and crush them in half, you know, that would making them unusable. And he did something else, and I can't, top of my head, remember what it was, but he did something that was very clear that it didn't want them there. And so the guy said, well, okay, it's, you know, we got the point, so we're leaving. And he said this is a spot he had been coming to for many years and never had any problems. And he said, yeah, I don't think we're going to be coming back to this spot next year. And so, and you know, I feel kind of bad, but I think after the rimfire area starts to recover, you know, starts getting food resources and trees growing back, I think the Bigfoots would probably move back to that other location, but I don't know that for sure. So so this guy, he's got his favorite camping space has been taken over by Bigfoot.
Right. Wow. And, you know, the bending of the pan and things like this. Kathy, can we gauge at all how intelligent Bigfoot might be?
Oh, I think they're very intelligent. I think that they have been very successful in keeping their population well hidden. You know, it's clear to me that they feel that humans are a danger to them, and so they just choose not to have an interaction. But I also think that knowledge probably, you know, they're not rocket scientists, you know, to be sure, but I think they're skilled at what they do, and I think that they're capable of a lot. I don't think that they're dangerous in any way, shape, or form. We're not a food resource for them at all, even though some Native Americans have long believed that Bigfoot ate humans on a regular basis. But we don't have any evidence of that today. So, but yeah, intelligent. I think that they use and know their land very well, and that they have a system. If you look at sightings, you can see clusters at certain times of the year when berries are ripe or when there's a certain resource in the area. So that tells me that they have to maintain that knowledge of where and when certain resources become available to them to utilize. And so that takes you know, a great deal of intelligence. I believe that they are travel great distances and that they have territories that they routinely use and come back to. I don't know what, you know, that cycle might be because, you know, it would depend on, you know, a lot of varying resources. Like I've had for some time been tracking seasonality, like does a sighting only occur when this happens or when this happens? And then you'll get periods where no sightings come in at all, and you're like, well, did the animal leave, you know, or did it move to a new location where there was better resources, or, you know, what's going on? And so I believe that they probably travel a lot more than what we're what we have suspected based on those resource needs, that they travel, and it's probably nothing for them to travel several hundred miles in a week, you know, walking here and there and looking for different things. So I don't think that that's an issue at all. But I do think that they have to move in order to get all the resources that they need and calorie intake that they need. It takes intelligence.
Right. Now we have a question from the chat room. How many Bigfoot do you think exist in this country, maybe at any given time?
You know, that's a really hard number to come up with because just here in my local area, I would have guessed that there was, you know, at least five just based on when things are happening. You know, we have sightings or events that will happen at nearly the exact same time, and I don't care how much you walk, you're not going to make it to both of those events at the same exact time. And so that's what I would have guessed. You know, what the population in California could be is probably, you know, 50 or so. So if you extrapolate that across the United States, it's at least 2,000 to have that kind of a breeding population. And so that's what I would guess. And I would guess that they're all situated in forested areas or, you know, at least high grasslands that have lots of resources. But water, like I said, is a critical factor. If the area doesn't, they're not going to be in the desert because there's just not enough water for any large-bodied mammal to survive. You have to have water. Water is life. And so any other place besides that, that's where you would find them.
All right. And another good question from the chat room is, how long do you think they live for?
Well, based on, and I use, as an anthropologist, you know, I've studied, not like full-time or anything, primates, but such as gorillas, chimps, the bobino, what their lifespan is, and I use that a lot to base my estimations and my thoughts of hypotheses of what I think is going on. And I think that they live a lot longer than we think. I think that it would not be unusual to have a 50-year-old individual at all. And because we do have people who say, who have settings of ones that they call gray and indicating great age, and we know apes at great age start to gray just like us poor humans. You know, they just don't have access to hair dye. So,
Yeah,
which is big, but that'd be a lot of hair dye. But, yeah, I think that they have a long lifespan.
Right, right. It seems that way, you know. And there was another question, too, which you addressed earlier, when you said you thought you saw a baby Bigfoot in the tree.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they obviously reproduce, you know.
Oh, yes, yeah. Oh, they have to reproduce. And what is the growth rate? I can't tell you. So I don't know, you know, the one that was the baby in the tree from last year, if somebody saw him this year, would he be XY? The taller, heavier, you know, I don't have any idea how long, you know, if they live to greater ages, they probably have, don't grow much differently than how human babies grow, that they have a time period where they're, you know, aren't able to walk or have to have lots of protection, all the way to then they're fully, you know, old enough to hunt on their own and go places, and mom and dad lets them do it, you know. And so there's, I think, greater chances is that they have a similar growth pattern as humans do.
Right. Do you think that some of the reports that Bigfoots are threatening, and I mean any animal or thing is going to be threatened, but if you come into their territory, so to speak. But do you think there's any like real like killer instinct to them?
I think no more so than a mother protecting her child would be. I have spent roughly 6 weeks in this area in Oklahoma. A few times I was scared of the situation that was occurring. I don't believe I ever thought he was going to kill me or harm me, but I was fearful of what the possibilities were, because of course, you know, I want to come home to my children and be with them, and they, you know, they want me to come home. So, I mean, I was nervous a few times, but I never really have ever believed, unless I did something incredibly stupid, like got in between a mother and a baby and, I don't know, try to pet him or something, that a mom would probably be very upset with me and might very well cause me harm. To protect her child, and frankly, that wouldn't ever surprise me for an animal to behave like that. So
right.
I guess that's, you know, I'm not afraid of bears. I would be afraid if I got in between a mother and her cub, and I had no place to go. I would definitely be afraid of that situation. And so,
right.
And I think that could be said for any animal.
And, yeah, I agree. In terms of, and I know you probably weren't close enough, but we hear about the stench, supposed stench of Bigfoots.
Yeah, no, I wasn't close enough in that instance to smell anything, but I definitely, probably last year, 2 years, definitely had something extraordinarily smelly be very near to me at nighttime in the dark, where I could not see what was causing the smell, but I sure could smell it, and it was awful. I mean, awful. And
yeah,
so
what did Kathy, not to make you, like, sick to your stomach, but what did it smell like?
It smells like a cross between, like, a wet horse, you know, very earthy, animal-y smell with maybe some dead fish thrown in. So a god-awful wild animal, sweaty, has obviously been in the dirt, thrown in with a fetid, rotten smell. And it's horrible. And there were several times where the wind got to blow, you know, when we were just, you know, taking it easy, and that smell would come into the camp, and you knew that there was one nearby because that smell was just so distinct. And I've been close enough to bears. I've been close enough to a lot of animals because I've been in the Forest Service for, you know, 24 years, and so I've had a lot of experience with other animals in my lifetime, and it bears smell better, and they don't smell very good, so.
Right.
I wouldn't want to be eating and have that come waft through the camp. It was bad.
Right. Now, so what, you know, you said when you had your first sighting at that time that someone or a Bigfoot, I guess, apparently had thrown a rock on the roof. I hear a lot about this throwing of the rocks. I don't know what that means, you know?
Well, I can't tell you what it means because I don't know what it means, but it is actually very common in this particular location where we research. It's very common, and it's almost like it's become a rite of passage, or I don't know what the word I want to use, but I know I This year when we went back, we went at a different time of year this year because because of the rim fire, I really did not have the luxury to just leave my employees and my work for an extended period of time until September this time, when in the past we've been in there in May and June. Well, I guess we went in April once, or my husband did anyway. And so last year, my husband and I went separately, and we each spent 3 weeks there apart from each other so that we could get the best bang for the buck kind of thing. And so it was successful, but it was very lonely, let me just put it that way. But the rock throwing, hitting things, wood knocking is frequent there. And I know this year, because of the heat, and I was already grouchy anyway because of the heat and a snake that had come into camp, and I was just wasn't in a good mood. I remember feeling very jaded about not getting the rock throws that I was very used to, that it's fairly common. And obviously it depends on what's going on in camp and what's going on with the animals, if they feel it necessary. But the most of the time when I have we take meticulous notes, of course, and you start seeing patterns that the rock throws, like it's very, very common for them to wood knock, which is just like taking a bat to the side of a tree, when somebody was coming into the area. And so usually a few minutes after I've heard a wood knock, you would then hear a motor of another member of the team coming into the area. So that,
wow,
that was a good indicator. We think that that's what that sound was meaning. The rock throws, I know one day we had not come out of the cabin in a timely manner, as I would like to say, and the rock throws were definitely an effort to get us outside because it was very clear that's what they wanted us to do. We had been inside the cabin too long. They wanted to know how many of us were there, what were we doing, you come outside right now. And so that was very apparent. But then there's other times where they can clearly see me. I'm sitting there, you know, eating lunch or whatever, and there'll be a rock thrown. It's just like, you can see me. You know where I'm at. Nobody's coming into camp because, you know, we know nobody was coming those particular days. Why are you throwing a rock? And so those I can't answer because I don't know what their mind frame is. There are times when I have, just in my own humor, pretended like it was like my teenage son just being a pain in the butt, you know, and just trying to annoy me, which was very successful. But, you know, I don't know the answer to that. So I can only hypothesize when the few times where we've had something happen and there be another interaction or another thing that tied to it, where I can suspect or hypothesize that's what's happening. There's other times I have no clue. I don't know why they do it other than they can and they do.
Right. So when the rocks would come on the roof, did you guys go outside?
Oh, yeah. We typically go outside, and we do, for those people who want to ask if we collect those, yes, we collect those, and we're firmly committed to have those tested for DNA in case the fingerprints, you know, there's something on it that would demonstrate DNA or anything like that. And so, and plus to verify that it was a rock. And so some poor sucker's got to climb up on this roof and retrieve those rocks. But sometimes, I mean, I've actually been, my husband this past year was just standing, doing absolutely nothing. He was just standing, and he was looking up the hillside, and he was talking to me about, you know, something. And he saw the rock come flying through his daylight, come flying through the trees, hit the roof, and bounced off, and he was able to pick it up off the ground. And then I've had a time where I was standing behind the cabin, and it was pitch black, and we had some other stuff going on, and so I thought maybe there was a Bigfoot nearby. And I heard the rock coming through the trees, and I moved just in time for that rock to hit the wall of the cabin where I had just been standing. If I hadn't been moved, I would have been hit. And
oh,
so,
my God.
Yeah, that didn't make me very happy. So, but I got another rock, and I tossed it back, but it, of course, didn't go very far because I throw like a girl. So, but, but, you know, that was, to me, kind of a little hostile, you know, like, did you not, and, you know, was that a mistake? You didn't really mean to try to hit me. the rock just got out of control, and it just was, you know, like every once in a while I have a lucky shot, and I didn't intend for it to actually go in the basket, but it'll go in, you know, because it was just like, oh, look at that. So I don't know if it was meant to intimidate me, to make me do something, like get out of that particular spot, or it was just accidental or what. I don't know. And so those are questions I'll have until, you know, until such time as the government or research pays somebody to sit out in the woods and do some regular research, we're not going to know those answers. Because we need a lot more observations in order to, okay, every time this happens, this is the consequence, and we just don't have it. We have good basic stuff, but it's not enough to answer some of those questions yet.
Right, right. And it just, I mean, you know, the fact that, you know, because we keep cutting down the forests, and, I mean, their spaces have got to be completely decreasing every year. And it's like, it's incredible to me that they could live unnoticed or mostly unnoticed anywhere in this country. I mean, I know there's big spaces, like, you know, when I drove through the country a couple times, I mean, there are, you know, spaces with nothing there hardly, but forests and such. But it just seems like, oh, you know, I feel bad for them that they're going to be ousted, you know, I mean, sooner or later.
Well, and there is, you know, that's definitely a concern, because, you know, while we have controlled cutting in U.S. Forest Service lands, we cannot control what happens on private land. We can't control everybody pieces of land. And what I feel is the most, besides deforestation due to harvesting of trees, to me, the biggest threat is the catastrophic wildfire, because what you saw a year ago in my area, we had two more very large fires on adjacent national forests to us. The El Dorado had 100,000 acre. And another forest had, I think, a 50-something acre. What it takes 100 years for trees to come back. I mean, they'll start small, but they won't become a forest for 100 years. And so that ecosystem that has birds and bugs and snakes and mammals and, you know, all that stuff that goes, it takes it a long time to recover for that ecosystem to be present again for all animals to use and enjoy. At the rate we're going, we're not going to have any habitat left, because fire is devastating. You know, it doesn't just select a tree here and there. It wipes it all out. This particular fire, there was we have broken down, we have a lot of useful tools that we use, such as satellites and a thing we call LIDAR, which is a tool that helps us map the surface of a forest so that we can see what's going on. And the mapping after the fire that we did showed that fire was so hot in certain areas that it killed the soil. So the soil has no ability to grow anything in it anymore, because we killed all the nutrients in it, and it's gone. So it's going to take geologically a certain amount of time for that to recover, and I can't tell you if that's 500 years or 1,000 years. And every time we seem to have these catastrophic fires, unless the U.S. Forest Service goes out and purposefully plants new trees, new pines and firs and oaks and those types of trees, what we're seeing is, because those fires are so hot, we're getting brush back. So we're getting like buck brush and deer brush growing instead, because they kind of like that yucky, hot, you know, terrain, because now there's no trees to shade anything down on the ground. And so systematically, the pines that were used to be at 3,000 feet are now only found at 5,000 feet, and soon that'll burn, and then those pines are only going to be at 7,000 feet. You know, at what point do we then tilt the scale towards there is nothing available for this species to latch onto and to survive? And, it's a huge concern, huge concern.
Yeah, geez, I know. It's really, it's so scary and just a horrible thing, you know. Of course, we haven't really taken care of our Earth anyways, all around, I'd say, but now it's just getting worse and worse, unfortunately. So say I happen to be lucky enough to be walking in the woods one day and I think I see a Bigfoot. What should I do, Kathy? I'm not going to run toward one like you did.
Tackle him. Put him in a headlock. So give me some of your hair. I would just, you know, people are probably going to be pretty mad at me for saying this, but there's all kinds of photographs out there. There's all kinds of film. And no matter what you do, you can't win. And so you could say, I got a picture of this Bigfoot, and somebody's going to say, no, that's hoax. That's somebody in a suit. That's something you hoaxed yourself. You put somebody there in a suit or somebody, you know, you just can't win no matter what you do. And so for me, I know it's much less of providing that evidence to somebody else who I don't know and don't care anything about versus enjoying the experience. And so I got my first one where I enjoyed it. You know, I blocked the camera with my hiney from getting that photographic evidence. That was my one. You know, anything outside of here I require of myself to take a photograph or get evidence of it. And so I'm hopeful that this place that we visit, if we continue to have the opportunity to go back, that we'll be able to find that evidence. But after you saw one, I would then go to the location where you found it, see if you can find some footprints. Can you find some hair that maybe the animal brushed up against that would provide that DNA? And make sure you report it. Make sure you tell somebody what happened so that they can maybe go out as well and look for that evidence. Because, you know, no animal really walks through a forest without leaving something. I mean, it's just how good are you at finding that evidence? And some of us are better than others, and some of us can't find anything. So it's that kind of stuff that we're looking for. But if you don't get a photograph because your mouth is hanging open because you enjoyed you're shocked about it going on, that's fine. You get to do that. That's fair.
Right. I don't know what I would do. I'd be shocked and maybe afraid, I think. But, you know, and I've not really told many people this, but years ago, Kathy, when I was about 15 years old, me and my sister's boyfriend were going to get a pizza. And I still do live in the same area. There's a park called Forest Park, which is it's pretty large. I'm not sure how large it is. I'm going to say 80 acres. No, that's not very big, right?
No, 80 acres isn't particularly big.
Okay. I don't know what it is. But anyways, we're going to go get a pizza, and on the side of the road, I swear I saw a Bigfoot. And I said, you know, okay, so it's standing there. It's just standing there. And we're driving pretty fast to go get the pizza. And I say to my sister's boyfriend, I think I just saw a Bigfoot. And of course, they didn't take me seriously. And of course, when we went back, you know, but how likely is it that I saw a Bigfoot? I mean, I wasn't drunk or anything. I was 15 years old and I, not a fanciful imagination, really. But I've heard of some reports. I'm in Massachusetts, by the way.
Mm-hmm, okay.
So, you know, have you heard anything about Massachusetts sightings per se?
Oh, yeah. There's a whole I just got a Christmas card from a gentleman who does Bigfoot studies in Massachusetts. He's called Squatchatootsits. I'm sure I'm butchering it. And so, yeah, there's stuff that has come out of there. And you know, and it's hard to evaluate what you might have seen, you know, so many years later. But I have firmly believed that a lot of activity happens at night that you wouldn't expect. You know, like we have an orchard around here that if that Bigfoot visited that orchard during the day, he's totally going to get caught because you can't miss him. you know, but during night hours when he really wants to get that fruit that's readily available to him, I think they very well do that. And there's lots of sightings that have occurred at nighttime where people have said, well, I was just driving by and the thing was just standing there. Well, it seems to happen quite often. And so why are they just standing there? Well, one of my favorite reports that I've investigated was a gentleman who was riding an OHV, which, the three-wheeler things, on the National Forest, and he was obviously making tons of noise, and he said in front of him he could see what appeared to be a Bigfoot. And he was just like, well, what is that? And he just, without changing what he was doing, he continued towards it. And the thing never turned to look at him. He said it was just looking closely at something that was on the other side of the road. It was fixated on it, just like it wanted it or something. He just was not paying attention to the sound that, here you have an ATV that is very loud approaching. You think the Bigfoot would have turned towards the OHV and then gone back into the forest, but he said it was almost the very last second that it did that, where it finally like got out of its daze or whatever and turned and looked, saw the ATV, and then stepped back into the forest. And the guy continued to ride by, and he said he could just see it, just it had just stepped just beyond the trees, you know, to hide itself, but it was continuing to stare at whatever it is that it was fixated on that was across the road. And so it, to us, maybe we would say, well, you know, if I was a Bigfoot, I would have, you know, gotten out of there. Well, we're not Bigfoot, so how do we know how a Bigfoot is supposed to behave or supposed to do? We don't know that information. And so for it to be standing on the side of the road without fear of being exposed, well, there obviously was something else going on that it was more important than hiding itself from a car that was not coming. So that's how I would view that.
Right. Wow. Because I know, and can you tell us again your website, Kathy, where we can find you and all sorts of information?
Oh, yeah, we have all kinds of stuff of what we have. Bigfoot calls that have been analyzed, been found that they don't know what the animal is on the tape. We have known animals recordings on there. There's how to do things scientifically, how do you cast a print if you find it, but that's BigfootResearch.com. We're known as the Alliance of Independent Bigfoot Researchers, and you also can find us on Facebook if you have any questions about science or if we can hook you up with somebody local in your area, because there's a lot of people out there nowadays, and if you have the opportunity to get in the woods and you want to get in the woods, then you know you should do so, because that's the only way you're going to learn anything or experience anything is going out in the woods. You're not going to learn it by never doing. So I highly encourage that.
Yeah, that sounds great. And in fact, I'm going to see if there's anyone in my area, because in Massachusetts, further north, I have friends that claim that they hear a Bigfoot all the time. And I'm not sure if that's what they're hearing, but in conjunction with that, there was another man who told me, who lives in that area, who said he was driving home one night and he saw a Bigfoot run across the road in that same area. So I wonder if the people that you know that are in this area know about those things. They must, you know, but
not necessarily. Let me give you his contact information. I had to go get the Christmas card that he sent me. And just to be silly for a minute, I love Christmas time because that's when I get a Bob Gimlin from the Patterson-Gimlin film is still alive, and he's a very good friend of ours, and he always sends me a Christmas card every year, and I've saved them for years.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Yes. It's Squatchatootsits, and the website is Squatchatootsits.com. It's SQUATCHACHUSETTS.com. And John Wilk is the founder of that group, and there's groups. I can't think of many states that wouldn't have a group, except maybe Hawaii. You know, so there's a lot of resources out there for people if they're interested, if they want to go out. I do caution people about the BFRO, which is the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization. They're great to report a sighting to, but I don't encourage people going on their expeditions because they charge to go on those expeditions, and that's ridiculous. There's no reason.
Oh.
National forests are free. So don't pay to enjoy your national forests. Those are free.
Well, I'm glad you told me that, Kathy, because that is, you know, one of the places that I have looked into in the past, you know.
Now, hook yourself up with John Wilk, and you can go out in the woods for nothing. So nobody has the right to charge for that experience. So
no, definitely.
You can find other people.
Right. This has been a fascinating, fantastic conversation. And, Kathy, once again, I so much appreciate you taking your time to talk to us and enlighten us about this. And I think I've asked every question I could ever want to know about Bigfoot. But, of course, I'm sure I'll think of more when the show's over. But I just want to say thank you so very much.
You are more than welcome. More than welcome.
And hopefully...
Go ahead.
Go on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, I appreciate people wanting to know more. So that it's never, I enjoy going on shows and just trying to share what I do know, and I have no issue with it. So thank you for having me.
Sure. And if you get some more, you know, evidence or something new comes up, we'd love to have you back on too, you know?
And sure.
And I hope you have a fabulous holiday, Kathy.
Thank you very much. You too.
You're welcome. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in. Alicia, Donna, Jennifer, Bright, C, Cupate, and Karen are just the ones left here now. Thanks, you guys, for listening. And we will see you next time. Thanks again to Kathy Strain.
Living hell of another world.
Step out of the world you see.
You do not respond.
The Supernatural Radio Show. Open up your mind.
We programmed your brain.
The Supernatural Radio Show.
You must learn to obey.
Brought to you by PurplePlates.com for harmony, healing, and living energy products for a greater quality of life. The Supernatural Radio Show.
That's